Okay. I guess I can. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay. So, of course, you're invited to keep eating while we go through this. Before we begin, it says so on the top. But I want to because this is Rabbi Landy's source sheet, which he was generous enough to share. If there are things that I think I want to add or continue with, I will certainly do it. But the question of the theological impact on the Holocaust. So I think there's sort of two ways, even at the very beginning, to think about this question. What would you answer? Someone said, why would there be a unique theological result of the Holocaust? What would you answer? What are the big theological questions that come up as a result of the Shoah? Where was God? Okay. Would you say that that question is somehow different than why do children get cancer or why do people die in car accidents? Right? Because there's one basic level to that question is, why is there evil? Why does the world seem to operate in such a way where bad things happen to people who don't seem to deserve it at all? And we could ask the corollary, of course, why is it that people who do seem to deserve it, whatever that might mean, are perfectly healthy? Right? So that's sort of one level of the conversation. And you might argue, so let's go back to that question. Is, from that perspective, the Holocaust different than children dying of leukemia? Why?
It's a massive genocide of 6 million people.
So it's scale. Yes. It's not evil, it's evil. Okay? It's a mass scale.
Children dying of leukemia is necessarily evil. Like, that's something that happens out of a natural cause. It's something that...
Okay, a tsunami wipes out... Right, as a theological question, though, if our theology assumes that God can prevent those things from happening, we would still... probably wonder why that would happen. Why would there should be a world where a tsunami hits and tens of thousands of people are wiped out? Why an earthquake should it? Why would God construct a world where these kind of things happen? I'm saying maybe. Some people are very bothered by that question. You might not be. Okay, that's fair. Yeah.
I think disease, we kind of think of it as sort of chance. Like, why did this person happen to get this disease? But the Holocaust... coming from the hands of humans seems like if God is omnipotent, why wouldn't God step in?
Well, why couldn't God step in to stop those things that happened by chance too? Why would God be more obligated to stop a human being from doing something bad than from a cancer cell invading somebody's body? I was putting that out there. In theory, you could say it's the same question. Yeah.
I also think it's a little different because with the Holocaust, there's a question of human nature. Like with the intent to kill on that kind of scale, why would God create human
Okay, so again, you could say, yes, it's different because this idea that, you know, human beings are capable of such terrible things, and I might still want to ask, why would God make viruses that can do these terrible things, right? Why would God, you know, make the world in such a way where the plates can disconnect and cause horrible damage? But I hear what you're saying. This extra question of humanity and are human beings this evil might be part of that as well. Yeah.
Maybe another layer is if you think about chosenness.
Ah.
God has a relationship with the Jews. So what does it say about
okay. Jews? So in addition, first of all other questions are valid, and I think we have to ask them. Okay? And I do think there is something about scale that's important. But I think there's an extra component here, which is why it's not just theology after the Holocaust, but it's Jewish theology after the Holocaust. Because there's an added wrinkle here in the idea that for thousands of years, there was an idea that the Jews had this covenantal relationship with God, okay, where it went something to the effect of, if you guys accept my Torah and follow my rules, then I indeed will watch over you and take care of you and protect you. And there is a sense that although, and again, we might want to say that the same questions that we ask about the Shoah, we could ask about the destruction of the temple, we could ask about the Spanish Inquisition, we can ask about the hundreds of thousands of Jews who died under Khmelnytsky. There are other tragedies to point to. Many of us may have a sense that the scope and scale of the Shoah sort of goes outside all of those bounds, which means we're not only asking, why would an omnipotent God who is supposed to be good, allow all this evil to happen? And we're not even only asking why would this omnipotent God create human beings with this capacity to do these terrible things, if indeed human beings are made in the image of God. But we're asking even another question, which is, how could the Jewish people still lay claim to some kind of relationship or covenantal relationship with God if this could happen to us? Right? As Elie Wiesel commented, right, it's okay to give us a mission, but you never told us it was a suicide mission. And indeed, if being Jewish is so dangerous, then how could we still want to lay claim to that identity? What kind of relationship with God might we be talking about? That, I think, is fundamentally what both of those questions, both tiers, what kind of God could allow this to happen is one question, which is not the first time humanity has asked that question. But there's another level to it of how do Jews continue to buy into this type of covenant relationship with that God if this could happen to Jews because they were Jewish, right? The horrible irony of if 400 years earlier Jews had assimilated or converted out, their descendants would not have been exposed to Hitler. They would have disappeared. They would have survived. The fact that their parents didn't make that choice exposed them to the inferno. And on that level, the question, I think, becomes very, very strong and almost overwhelming. Yeah.
Is it inherently different in the fact that it occurred at a time where Jews were more able and willing to question God's existence within their society?
I'm not sure I'm following. Say a little bit more.
As in, we had movements within the Jewish people that were moving away from God and traditional views of God and tradition in general, whereas I'm not sure if that was the case at the time of the Spanish Inquisition.
Were more options open to us and how we're going to respond to all this?
Right. Do our theological questions end up being completely different?
I would think almost inevitably, right, we're going to think about that, right, in terms of what are the theological options open to us. But I think for the thinkers that we're going to look at, something really unique happened here. That seems to be, well, except for Visegrad, which we'll look at him also, but something, many Holocaust theologians are struggling with the question of somehow this is unique. That although the Jewish people have faced destruction and disaster in the past, somehow what happened here is raising the questions in such a way that is demands maybe different types of answers than we've given in the past. Right? Let's look at that for a minute. What have been the standard answers that Jews have given in the past to tragedy? What comes to mind? What are you aware of from studying Tanakh or looking at the Siddur? Okay, so which means what? Why does destruction happen? Punishment, right? One, and certainly a very dominant traditional answer to why disaster befalls the Jewish people, is we're being punished for something, right? We've deserved it somehow, and this is God's way of correcting us or making it better. What else? Yeah. That's another one. Our faith is being tested, right? Suffering gives us an opportunity to somehow rise above. It's a challenge that we're going to grow from. Yeah?
It's a necessarily a succeeding event.
Okay, the Gum Zulatova, right? That this terrible thing is going to lead to something that's much better, therefore we have to go through it, right? A childbirth. Giving birth to a child is very painful. It wasn't for me at all, in fact, but for my wife, apparently it hurt. That's what she said. Can't verify. But the, I'm being taped. That was inappropriate. got to remember that. Right? But it's, that this pain will somehow be justified in a future event. There's one more. What's the book of Job's response to evil? It's a mystery. It's just a mystery. There are a lot of mysteries in life, and this is another mystery that we're going to have to contend with, right? So all four of those answers appear. Is there another one someone thought of that I didn't mention? For many people, those answers, we're going to see in a minute, at least in the face of the Shoah, at least three out of the four of them seem to be very, very hard to say, right? Punishment, let's start with that. Why is punishment so hard to say in the face of the Shoah? right? This sense of, it's inconceivable that a merciful, kind God would punish in this way. It's just too extreme, too horrible, too horrific, okay, that God would ever punish us this way. What else? What about the idea of growing from challenge? It's suffering that we're going to learn. It's a test. Right? Saying, who tests this way? Right? Who tests this way? This is beyond our notion of anything that we could imagine. A third of the Jewish people being wiped out, 1.5 million children. It's inconceivable to think of that somehow a test, at least for many people, that we're going to grow from. And the third one really is very tough, right? Gumzu Latova, that this is somehow all for the good. I think for many of us, it's inconceivable to imagine what kind of tova could ever justify. Maybe one could say, if Mashiach had come to redeem the entire world in 1945, then maybe, and I add maybe, we might be able to wrap our brains around that. But Mashiach didn't come in 1945. And if he had, the first thing you might want to have asked him is, couldn't you have come 2 years earlier and saved 4 million lives? So those models are very, very difficult. Yeah. I have heard some people say that. Again, first of all, we'd have to even check out whether historically that's even accurate. Would the State of Israel not have come into being if the Shoah hadn't happened? I don't know how to look at that. I think many people, as wonderful as having a State of Israel is, 6 million lives is an incomprehensible price to pay. Right? It's one thing to talk about the 6,000 lives that were lost in the War of Independence. That also is a pretty big number. But okay, I can wrestle with that in my brain and say that's what happens in a war, and Israel was given birth in a war. 6 million is, for me personally, I couldn't utter that statement.
I second that motion.
Okay? Again, if Mashiach ben David had come in 1945 and the whole world was redeemed to now live in peace and harmony and justice, maybe. Although I'd still want to know why it had to happen, but maybe. The State of Israel, for me, I couldn't do it, but yes, there are some people out there who would say that. And again, our purpose here is not to judge how anybody wrestles with these problems. Before we look at some of these actual answers, I have a question. It's curious to me. What has been the impact of the Holocaust on Judaism? I didn't say Jewish identity. I'm saying Judaism. Let me give you a little thought experiment, okay? If a observant Jew in 1930 had been put into a time capsule, and then he came back and you took him out and he went to Shul in 1960, Shabbat morning, okay? You took him out and you put him in, would he know the Holocaust had happened because he went to Shul on Shabbat in 1960? You say yes. Why? Avoid that for a minute. Let's assume he was in America in 1930, and now it's 1960. Just by going to shul, okay? Would he know? When you open up the siddur, he'd go through the tefillah, would he know that a Holocaust had happened?
If he looked at every page.
If he looked at every page. When's the last time you looked at every page of this siddur? And by the way, most Orthodox siddurim, I wouldn't even agree with that one. But okay, fine. Well, other answers. Would you know? No? If you dropped them in on a Pesach Seder.
Yes.
Why?
I think that Pesach is the story of our liberation.
Right.
Exodus, and like, we have that a lot of times, like social justice, atrocities, liberation.
Okay. Sometimes it comes up, sometimes it doesn't. But to the best of my awareness, in the traditional Haggadah at least, the Holocaust is not mentioned. Jewish bookstore. I don't know. There's, how about 1970, 1980? Okay, there's some books. Okay, what I'm trying to get. So, what can we point to in terms of Judaism that has been transformed by the Shoah? Yeah.
I don't think that the liturgy changed, but I think that the way that Judaism plays out in our lives has changed a lot. Like, I don't know that looking at the siddur you'd be able to tell, but if you talk to people in the shul. and not asking, like, what's happened in the last 30 years, like,
right.
it would come up because of the way that we relate to Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of Judaism is, like, very post-Shoah Judaism, not even in terms of identity.
What are your examples when you think of that? Because it's interesting, you start by saying the liturgy hasn't changed. That's striking, right? Because after the destruction of the temple, we could argue, liturgy changed dramatically. I know the temple is destroyed just by reading the Musaf prayer.
Maybe not in the first 60 years.
It may have taken a while. That was an interesting question. But you're saying it's the practices are the same, but maybe our consciousness is different. Yeah.
Well, this may actually be addressing the identity, but it seems like if I think about all my friends growing up, and who, like, where they descend from, so many of them descend from Holocaust survivors.
Okay.
So inevitably, if you lived in America and then fell asleep for 30 years and woke up, you would see so many Europeans, and you would have to wonder why the sudden influx of...
I hear you, but I'm asking a very specific question, which I just want to note, that it's striking to me, at least, okay, how small the direct measurable impact the Shoah has had on Jewish practice. Not Jewish identity, not the Jewish people, but on Judaism and Jewish practice.
What about Tisha?
Again, in Tisha B'Av, in some places it's not mentioned. In some places, they add one kina at the end that mentions the Shoah.
I've been to a synagogue where, like, most of the teaching were about the Shoah.
It could be. Again, that to me would be very, very new. My sense is, though, for the average Tisha B'Av observers out there, the Shoah has not totally remade the ninth of Av. Right? We haven't replaced Nachem with a Shoah prayer, and we haven't changed. There is no text, right? There's no Megillah that has been written, that is read publicly, that tells the story of the Shoah. Okay, that could be an answer. That could be an answer. Yeah.
Well, Haredi, like, Judaism has rapidly grown.
Or, like, Satmar.
Yeah.
Wait, why did Satmar grow out of the Holocaust?
The Satmar Rebbe, like, when he came to America, like, the foundation of living in America, living in the insular community, and having a lot of children, he, when he first came to America, spoke about it being a complete reaction.
A lot of, like, from my understanding, a lot of, like, the response to theology within the Holocaust, a lot of it was Haredi, like, growth.
Well, we'll take a look. It's interesting, because my reaction, the Shoah probably killed about 2 million Haredi Jews. So whether or not there's been Haredi growth in America in the last 40 or 50 years, there's no way in my mind that comes close to replacing the growth that would have occurred in the ultra-Orthodox world that was in Poland and Eastern Europe. But the point I'm trying to make is somewhat provocative, and that is that it might be that Holocaust theology, what we're going to do here, does not seem to have penetrated into our everyday practice of Judaism. And I just want us to think about that question as to why. Because it's a very interesting question to think about. Okay, let's take a look at what we have here. I would say the strongest post-Holocaust theologian that really made a big splash, and you can see he wrote this in 1966, so it's a good 20 years after the Shoah, was Richard Rubinstein, in a collection of essays which he wrote called After Auschwitz. Does someone want to read the first paragraph? Go ahead.
I am amazed at the silence of contemporary Jewish theologians on this most crucial and agonizing of all Jewish issues. How can Jews believe in an omnipotent, beneficent God after Auschwitz? Traditional Jewish theology maintains that God is the ultimate, omnipotent actor in the historical drama. It has interpreted every major catastrophe in Jewish history as God's punishment of a sinful Israel. I fail to see how this position can be maintained without regarding Hitler and the SS as instruments of God's will. The agony of European Jewry cannot be likened to the testing of Job. to see any purpose in the death camps, the traditional believer is forced to regard the most demonic, anti-human explosion in all history as a meaningful expression of God's purposes. The idea is simply too obscene for me to accept.
Now, if you take a look farther down, right, he has that sentence, finally the time of the death of God. Rubinstein talks about the death of God. Now, he doesn't mean that an omnipotent being died and needs to be buried somewhere out there in the cosmos. What does he mean by the death of God? What is Rubinstein saying here? Yeah.
Fundamental change in how we view God.
Yeah, he's saying there's no way to square the circle. There is no way to maintain a belief in a personal omnipotent being after the Shoah has occurred. Because he's saying then somehow the Shoah has to be an expression of this God's will. And he's saying that that's impossible. So he's standing up and saying the old paradigm is done. The Shoah shattered it. There's no way to hold on to the traditional paradigm. Now, he goes on to argue. He doesn't think that's necessarily the end of Judaism and the Jewish people, but he does argue fundamentally that the traditional God concept is gone. And he says somewhere the most we can believe in is some kind of infinite nothingness, which is not a very, it's not a happy essay. Just, you know, in the end, there are no smiley faces at the end. It's a very dark, dark writing. But his argument was, at the end of the day, the traditional God concept is over. There's no way to live with the Shoah and a personal supernatural being that's guiding the universe and entering into covenants with the Jewish people. Yeah. He was a scholar, an academic, a philosopher. And the reason he's kind of fell out of play, I think he was at Cornell. Is that correct? I think he was at Cornell. He later became very attracted to very right-wing politics. So people like stopped reading him so much. But he was, I think, he was one of the first to basically draw this conclusion and write about it publicly, that the traditional God concept is over. Now, it's no accident. I think it probably took about 15, 20 years for Jews to start writing post-Holocaust theology. And you can understand why, right? The trauma is so enormous, it took some time for people to reflect. But his was the challenge. Everybody that came after him felt they were somehow writing in response to Rubinstein's gauntlet, right? Which is basically to look every traditionally believing Jew in the eye and say, how can you tell me you believe in that after Auschwitz, right? Auschwitz is the defining break between traditional theological belief and what comes after. If I could ask, how many people had that thought while you were there? I know it's a very personal question. Had that thought when you were there that somehow Auschwitz is a break, a traumatic break with everything that came before it, everything that's going to come after it? Yeah. Can you describe like a sentence or two?
Like, maybe not directly related to God, but there's something about the way that everyone has to perceive the world that in this one place, so many people could have been penned up and killed, basically, that you can't look at the world the same way you did before that.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I also thought there's a break, but I think I wasn't thinking theologically. I think I was thinking just in terms of human history. But there is like a
turning point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a turning point that you felt was a break, like to something like new, that, or
I didn't feel like something new. It was just like you can never go before, like you can never go to
right.
any time.
There's
no. There's no going back to anything that was before that.
Interesting.
Like that is like a new roadblock that you can never.
Yeah.
We often show it as a big, jagged, black, dark hole, in like a tapestry of Jewish life, and you just come up to the edge, and there's nothing you can do except maybe starting with the record of moving. You just cannot.
But did you have God thoughts then? Yes.
At that point, I think our tour guide told us that there were writings about when people would go into the gas chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jewish workers who had to work in the gas chamber did
wrote about their experiences, and they heard that mostly people were praying.
Mm-hmm.
And when they knew, like, they knew they were going to die, like, they figured out what had happened. And I remember when I heard about that, I was thinking, like, what I would do in that situation. Like, what were they praying for? Or if it was, dissonance for me with that image.
How'd that make you feel when you thought of the idea of Jews praying before they were when they were in the gas chamber? Yeah.
I just to pick up on that. I mean, I haven't been for a number of years, and when I went, I didn't feel anything. But reading, anything more. But yeah, I mean, like, I guess I thought of it like, if somebody survived the Holocaust and said, "I still believe in God," like, who am I to tell them, like, there's no God? And similarly, if someone's sitting, you know, they're saying Shema before they're dying, whatever is behind that, like, who am I to say, you know, I have no right to lose belief if they didn't, I guess, is kind of how I felt.
Yeah.
I think when you, like, in immense fear, there's just, like, a reaction to turn to the end, to God or the unknown. And, I know when I'm scared, I got money. And so when I heard that and when I was there, it didn't feel surprising or, yeah.
Like it made sense to you in a certain way.
Yeah. For me personally, right. It made a lot of sense.
Interesting. Yeah.
I think there's an heartening aspect of that as well, that so much of the Nazis' goal was to deprive us of our spiritual identity. And the fact that through to the last moment, there were people who maintained it is just very impressive to me.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that I don't think it's a unique situation. I think that it happened before when, like, Jewish martyrs were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it happens today. Like, I watched a documentary a couple years ago on Roy Klein, the soldier who jumped on the grenade, and before he jumped, like, he said, Shema.
Right.
You know? And, like, I think, it very, very much like what Tamima said, although I would actually say not so much turning to the unknown, but actually the familiar, and something that just feels safe. And I thought about this before, too, and how, like, you know, with all of my education and immersion in Jewish life, I could see how, when there are no words, the first words that come to mind are prayer.
Yeah.
The ready-made words.
I don't think Rubenstein, by the way, was judging the people who are there. I think for him it's just more about, we've reached a place of moral impossibility. That to ascribe to a God that can interact with the world in the face of Auschwitz or Rubenstein is just inconceivable. That's just inconceivable. Because then God would be demonic. Right? There's nothing God could do, which is a little bit in response to your question with the state of Israel. There's nothing God could do subsequently that would ever make God be okay with allowing the Holocaust to happen. So if Rubenstein, it's just a moral chasm that can't be crossed. A benevolent being, all-powerful being, could never allow this. So if Rubenstein, there's only one path ahead, and that is that God is gone, and then we have to figure out something else, which I told you, he's very vague on the specifics of what that would look like and how that would work. The next one I want to look that's here that's worth, I think, important to look at is Fackenheim, who drew a very different conclusion. This first sentence about the voice of Auschwitz commanding, I think, is in a way is his most famous. He was a Jewish philosopher who was in Canada. He was in Toronto. He made Aliyah, I think, in the 80s, 70s or 80s. And he was one of the premier modern Jewish thinkers of his time. Jews are forbidden to hand Hitler posthumous victories. They are commanded to survive as Jews, lest the Jewish people perish. They are commanded to remember the victims of Auschwitz, lest their memory perish. They are forbidden to despair of man and his world, and to escape into either cynicism or otherworldliness, lest they cooperate in delivering the world over to the forces of Auschwitz. Finally, they are forbidden to despair of the God of Israel, lest Judaism perish. A secularist Jew cannot make himself believe by mere act of will, nor can be commanded to do so. And a religious Jew who has stayed with his God may be forced into new, possibly revolutionary relationships with him. One possibility, however, is wholly unthinkable. A Jew may not respond to Hitler's attempt to destroy Judaism by himself cooperating in its destructions. In ancient times, the unthinkable Jewish sin was idolatry. Today, it is to respond to Hitler by doing his work. Let that sink in for a moment. What's he saying? How could we be commanded anything after Auschwitz? Who's commanding us? Well, but if it's ourselves, then presumably I could reverse the command, right? And he's saying it's forbidden for me to do so. Yeah. Because of Zionism, more specifically.
Yeah. And so, like, to do everything you can to be the opposite of what happened.
Right, but remember, he's operating in a punishment, a God as punisher model. Fackenheim isn't.
No.
I'm just saying, the Samir Rebbe is. And so, therefore, for him, the tshuva after the punishment is to oppose what brought the punishment. But that's a very different model. I'm just trying to get you to separate between what the Satmar Rebbe is talking about and Fackenheim. Fackenheim is not saying the Holocaust is punishment. Okay. Yeah.
Fackenheim almost seems to put history as a force of nature and combine it with Darwinism, essentially, to say there's this force that has commanded us that if we do not do X, then this is the outcome, which is...
Yeah, what's the force? Well, but it's not neutral, though, right? What force are we fighting against?
Evil.
Evil. Right, he is saying... Yeah, go ahead.
I would like to get back to the question that you asked earlier about how little Jewish practice was impacted by the Holocaust, and I think it's a response to not allow that... not like, if you're a victim of a traumatic event, to not allow that to define your identity...
Well, it's interesting. Fackenheim is almost saying both. On the one hand, it's the defining element of our identity, but the way it's going to define it is we're not going to let our identity be undone by the evil, right? Because I think he's basically saying Hitler represents the ultimate force of evil in the world. What's the only way to confront evil? Goodness. You've got to defy it. If evil's agenda is to wipe out Jews and Judaism, then Fackenheim is saying that must mean goodness's agenda is to oppose that. So if Hitler, as the agent of evil, wants to get rid of Jews, then the only response is to do the opposite of that evil agenda and to make sure that Jews and Judaism continues, even knowing, I think he's saying, we can't solve the questions about where was God and how does this make sense and how does covenant make sense. He's acknowledging we can't, because the secular Jew, if he can't believe, he can't believe, and the religious Jew has no right to ignore and pretend that nothing happened. Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to be, at least in this, you know, paragraph that you gave us, it doesn't seem to be a question of good and evil. He doesn't use that language.
That's the limit of the paragraph. That's the limit of the paragraph. Yes, because Hitler's victory is a victory for evil. Yeah. He uses that terminology of good and evil. Any other reactions? What do you think of this? Because some people, I'll tell you, have critiqued Fackenheim because it implies making the Holocaust at the center of Jewish identity. And what do you think about that? Should we teach that to young Jewish kids? Your obligation to be Jewish is because you have to oppose Hitler. What do you think about that as an educational strategy? Yeah.
I don't read that from this, that is the center of Judaism. I think it's an aspect when you discuss the Holocaust, our response is, here's how we respond to strength.
Well, let's just go with it for a minute. Let's assume that for him, that's the essential remaining Jewish command. to continue, because to not hand Hitler a posthumous victory? Do you want to present one's obligation as a Jew in that frame?
No.
Because?
Because it's defining ourselves against something that tried to kill us instead of positively defining ourselves for ourselves.
Okay, yeah.
I think the issue is if it's somebody that's already a practicing Jew shortly after the Holocaust and they're starting to lose faith and stop doing all these things, and you say you need to keep doing these things because without better phrasing, you don't want Hitler to win, you need to keep this up. I think that's different than telling an elementary school kid, we practice Judaism because we don't want Hitler to win. Because the other person understands why the rituals are done and they understand the philosophy. But if you're just doing something only for the sake of doing it, then Judaism sort of loses its background, the reasons why we do everything. It's just sort of motion.
Hold on to that thought when we get to the next thinker, yeah?
Does he mean this as a long-term fix or just a short-term reaction?
I think I understand to be in perpetuity. The ultimate evil wants to destroy Judaism. The ultimate good would be to pursue it and to maintain it.
I don't know. I guess to me, I feel like there's always been, there's always been evil facing the Jewish people, and there's always been threats to faith. I don't know. To me, this is like okay, this terrible thing has just happened. Let's not let it beat us, and then once things kind of return back to normal, we can resume our, regular programming, which has helped us survive over the last X number of years.
Yeah. I don't know, by the way, some of these thinkers, Rubinstein and Fackenheim probably both don't think there's ever a return to regular programming. Hold on to that thought, because there are some thinkers, I think, point in that direction, but not them. They believe that something fundamental has happened, is transformed, and we're not going to go back. But you're right. We do have that sense. Like, you wonder, 1,000 years after the destruction of the temple, are people still thinking in those terms? But our liturgy would suggest that in some ways we are and we do. Yeah.
I just feel like he's, sucked Judaism dry. Sucked all the awesomeness out of it. In the sense of, I wasn't really getting what you meant by ultimate good and evil until you just said, until you explained, that the ultimate evil was the attempt at destroying Judaism, and thus the ultimate good is maintaining it.
Correct. Correct.
But sustaining it, there's no inherent relationship between goodness and sustaining Judaism unless you actually know what's good about Judaism. What is qualitatively good about it? But he's not saying that there is anything. He's just saying that we can recognize the ultimate evil. And if their aim was X, then the necessary good is automatically the opposite.
I think
that's really...
Yeah, there's an element there. I don't think he would say there's no ultimate good in Judaism, by the way. I do, but I think he would say...
Yeah, but if you're identifying the reason...
Because he's talking about the commanding element of Judaism. I think that's his point. Ultimate goods, people can pursue or not pursue to some degree or do it in their own way. He's saying, though, the Jews can't abandon the path of Judaism because of this command. Doesn't mean that Judaism doesn't have goodness, but I think there's something here that the commanding element, the reason you must be Jewish today, is because of Hitler. It doesn't matter if you can find other goods and other paths, you can't allow Judaism to falter. Not you personally, but everybody.
It's not very compelling.
All right, I hear you. A lot of people have critiqued it. I want to move on since we're losing time here a little bit, and you certainly are encouraged to take a look at these. Number four and number five, I think to myself, are the sort of the normative response. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Michael Wischegrad is still a very interesting theologian, and I think he's in Texas, if I'm not mistaken, and a traditionalist. And he wrote a really interesting book called The Body of Israel, I think it's called, where he looks at Jewish identity from a very interesting perspective. Take a look at what he says. Israel's faith has always centered about the saving acts of God, the election, the Exodus, the temple, and the Messiah. However more prevalent destruction was in the history of Israel, the acts of destruction were enshrined in minor fast days, while those of redemption became the joyous proclamations of the Passover and Tabernacles, of Hanukkah and Purim. The God of Israel is a redeeming God. This is the only message we are authorized to proclaim, however much it may not seem so to the eyes of non-belief. Should the Holocaust cease to be peripheral to the faith of Israel? Should it enter the Holy of Holies and become the dominant voice that Israel hears? It could not be but a demonic voice that it would be hearing. There is no salvation to be extracted from the Holocaust. No faltering Judaism can be revived by it. No new reason for conviction of the Jewish people can be found in it. Do you hear him responding to Fackenheim? If there is hope after the Holocaust, it is because to those who believe, the voices of the prophets speak more loudly than did Hitler, and because the divine promise sweeps over the crematoria and silences the voice of Auschwitz. I, by the way, I've actually taught that paragraph in a couple other places, and people were deeply offended by this paragraph. Deeply, deeply offended. But I'm curious what you think his message is, and I'll tell you why I think why people said they were so offended. What do you think? What's he saying? Yeah.
It sounds like he's challenging if the Holocaust is in fact something so special within Jewish history, and also if, as such, there's any real reason to give it some sort of elevated status.
There is that piece, number one, which he does say in other places. The problem of evil has been with us for a very long time, and that we could argue scope and scale, but the theological problem of God allowing evil, our ancestors have always had to live with that problem. That's one piece, I agree with you, that's in the mix, but there's something else too, yeah.
I mean, I think it's a lot easier to publish that now than it was, it could have been in 1973, because to the many Holocaust survivors who were alive then, it's an unavoidable fact that the single greatest trauma they've ever experienced was
so what? Yeah.
Faith in a religious life.
So what do you think he's telling them? It's a great question. What do you think he's telling them, or he's telling all of us?
To find your faith not through that, but through something else. But is that really feasible for somebody who's been through it?
I don't know if he's speaking to survivors. Like, I don't think he's taking a survivor and saying you need to, get over it. Oh, so you're in a concentration camp? Get over it. We've all suffered. He is definitely not that insensitive. But well, there were people who read it also, but being insensitive, like one step removed. Are you really saying that we're supposed to just sort of, put this in with the Spanish Inquisition and Chmelnytsky and the Churban HaBayit, and just, this is a problem, and the Jewish response is, we don't delve into it. We don't make it at the centerpiece. We don't put evil at the center. We say Hallel, and we cultivate gratitude, and we cultivate salvation. Yeah?
I think the message is don't let it consume you. Like, I've talked to people who have survived cancer. It doesn't diminish what they've been through to say, like, I don't want to be defined by my disease. Like, I have a life and a family and all these other things. I don't think it diminishes, like, how horrible it was. Fair.
Victoria.
This reminds me very much of what people who were POWs in Hanoi have told me. Because I was a journalist, I actually knew several people who were POWs here in the Vietnam War and during Korea. And to a man, they all said, this happened to me, and now I've got to go on with my life. I'm a better person for this experience, but it doesn't matter.
All right. I mean, the whole question, though, if we can analogize between individual challenge and suffering and the fact that the Holocaust happened to Am Yisrael as a collective, right? Because he's saying we're going to select the good things that happened to Am Yisrael as a collective, we're going to go to Shul and make holidays out of and talk about, and the bad stuff we're going to acknowledge, but in lowercase letters, because if we don't, he's saying, we could never affirm this ultimate picture of a God that's good and who saves and is involved in the world and gave us a mission and gave us a Torah and everything else. Yeah?
Just because you said this is a thing that happened to Am Yisrael, does anybody respond to the fact that, the gadol, it happened to Am Yisrael, but in the practical sense, it didn't. Because there were so many, Sephardi Jews were not so connected to the Holocaust. The people who came to America before the Holocaust weren't so affected. There are a lot of people, like we saw on our trip, how few of us were the grandchildren of survivors because we, thank God, escaped it. So then, what does that mean in terms of reactionary Judaism when, on a personal level, it wasn't all of us?
It's a good question. I don't know. I guess for some people, the Jewish people are a collective. Therefore, if it happens to the Jews because they're Jews, there's a sense that we're all somehow affected and responsible. But you're right, there's a difference between people's personal history. And I would assume that you're right. Sephardic kids in this country don't tend to go on Poland trips, from what I understand. Right, because they don't feel that same connection. But in principle, I'm not Sephardic, but the stories of the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion from Spain, at least I see that as happening to my people. But it's a very fair question. And you could even ask one step further, even those who are descended from Holocaust survivors, how personal does a story feel when it's five generations back, seven generations back? Is that still your story? That's a good question, too. We'll take one more comment, then we got to go on to Berkowitz. Yeah, you want to say something. Your hand was up. Don't deny it.
I was just going to say that in contrast to the Frankenheim, it seems like he's saying that the ultimate posthumous victory for Hitler would actually be allowing the Holocaust to dominate your theology and your approach to Jewish life. And that would actually be the ultimate victory that you could give to Hitler, and sort of like having him be at the center, him and his you know, life's work to be at the center of your way of life, that would be the ultimate victory for him.
Mm. No, you're like combining in a way. It's interesting. That you're saying Wish of God really is affirming Fackenheim, but basically by saying, no, you can't even talk about it. If you really want to win, then let's stick with our initial plan. Focus on salvation.
If Hitler's goal is going to be like the greatest service to the history of humankind by eliminating Jewish people, that to say, nope, you're one of a line and a string of people who tried to do that in the history of the human race, and you are nothing more than that.
Wow. Anybody else? So let's take a look briefly at Eliezer Berkowitz. And he, I think, of all of them, is sort of, you know, dealing the most with the theological problem, really the problem that you raised. How could it be that human beings, that God could create a world where human beings could do something like that? And what do we do with all of that? In a sense, God can be neither good nor bad. In terms of his own nature, he is incapable of evil. He is the only one who is goodness. But since, because of his very essence, he can do no evil, he can do no good either. God, being incapable of the unethical, is not an ethical being. Goodness for him is neither an ideal nor a value. It is existence. It is absolutely realized being. Justice, love, peace, mercy are ideals for man only. They are values that may be realized by man alone. God is perfection. Yet because of his very perfection, he is lacking, as it were, one type of value, the one which is the result of striving for value. He is all light. On just that account, he is lacking the light that comes out of the darkness. One might also say that with man, the good is axiology, with God, ontology. Man alone can strive and struggle for the good. God is good. Man alone can create value. God is value. But if man alone is a creator of values, one who strives for the realization of ideals, then he must have freedom of choice and freedom of decision. And his freedom must be respected by God himself. God cannot, as a rule, intervene whenever man's use of freedom displeases him. It is true, if he did so, the perpetration of evil would be rendered impossible, but so would the possibility for good also disappear. Man can be frightened, but he cannot be bludgeoned into goodness. If God did not respect man's freedom to choose his course and personal responsibility, not only would the moral good and evil be abolished from the earth, but man himself would go with them, for freedom and responsibility are the very essence of man. Without them, man is not human. If there is to be man, he must be allowed to make his choices in freedom. If he has such freedom, he will use it. Using it, he will often use it wrongly, for he will decide for the wrong alternative. As he does so, there will be suffering for the innocent. So what's Berkowitz saying here? When we go through Auschwitz and we ask the question that Sarah asked, what kind of God could create human beings with this kind of capacity? What kind of God would allow human beings to act on those kind of impulses and make others suffer to the extent that we are now witnessing? What is Berkowitz's answer to that problem? Yeah.
Necessary compromise.
Why?
According to his definitions, without good, there's no evil. Without good, without evil, there is no good. Therefore, evil of some kind is absolutely necessary in order for man to actualize the good for which he is destined or what he is tasked to do.
But why? Why can't people just be good?
That's just what the definitions are in this world.
Well, I think he's saying something a little bit more about that. What makes an action that people do a good action?
That we chose it.
Right? If you give tzedakah, what is the difference between giving tzedakah and having somebody come to your house and take your TV out and sell it for tzedakah? In both cases, you $400 left your bank account in some way and entered into the account for a poor person. What is the difference between those two moments? Why should choice matter? The poor person still got $400. What's the problem? So what else matters? Why is the choice important, Molly? Stick with that thought for a moment.
Choice is important because it affects the individual's relationship to what happens.
Because if he chooses it or she chooses it, okay.
It's like theirs.
And if they chose to give tzedakah, what does that say about them?
That they have a value.
That they have a value. They have a caring value and they acted on it. As opposed to the person who's out the TV set, if it's forced upon you, it is not an indication of any kind of ethical choice. In order to behave ethically, we need the freedom to choose otherwise. Because otherwise, I'm not behaving ethically. I'm just following a rule. If you take somebody's hand and force it, then they have not chosen a value. They haven't. The only way they can be good is if they have a capacity to choose evil. Otherwise, all their behaviors are value neutral. There's no value in it if you have to do it. It's only if you could choose otherwise that choice says something about you, right? It tells me something about your character. If you're forced to do it, there was no character involved. Because Berkowitz is saying without the freedom to choose.
So God wants man to choose.
God built us that way, because that's the only way we can become good. The only way we can grow and become who we are, Berkowitz's argument is if we have the capacity to choose otherwise. But then here's the rub. If we have the capacity to choose otherwise, if God is going to maintain our freedom, then he can't punish us every time we do something wrong. Because what happens if you punish someone every time they do something wrong? It's not a choice. You're right. The choice has been taken away. Right? If we hooked everybody up to electrodes, and every time they spoke Lashon Hara, they would automatically get a zap, believe me, people would stop speaking Lashon Hara. As much as we like it, we would still stop. Just a question of how high you had to turn up. You're like, well, this is so juicy, it's worth a quick jolt. If you turn it up high enough, they'll stop. We know this to be true. If you punish people enough, you can punish them out of almost every behavior. Because they make that built-in calculation of pleasure and pain, and they figure it out. But that's not ethical. That's not becoming an ethical, good person. That's being forced and coerced. So if God punished people all the time for their evil, he would not be leaving us any capacity to choose goodness and become ethical people ourselves. But he says here, because of that, innocent people pay a price. Because when bad people, or not bad people, when people choose to do bad things, it's not only them that suffer. Sometimes their bad things are bad to other people. Right? When a person acts on their free will to steal from somebody else, they did a bad thing, and the person who lost their stuff is paying a price for their freedom. So what do you think of all that? When you think about that with the Shoah, how does that register in your brain? Yeah. So meaning what?
Like maybe they weren't the ones who conceived of the idea or were leading the way, that they were in a position where they were carrying it out.
Mm.
They lost some of their humanity.
There's no question one of the most disturbing books ever read was Daniel Goldhagen's Hitler's Willing Executioners. Because I'm not an expert, and maybe people have proven him wrong since, but he seems to show rather conclusively that the people who participated in the killing did so freely, because those who opted out were not punished for it. And it was the worst thing I ever read, because one of the ways I would sort of allow myself to live with all this was the idea that there were 20 really evil people, and they managed to coerce or frighten everybody else into doing what they wanted them to do. And the minute he wrote that book, and it said basically no, they were basically volunteers in those units, and if they wanted out of them, they could have gotten out. It was devastating to me. Doesn't mean what you're saying isn't true, but like it added to the whole element of that people were actually freely choosing to behave in this way. And it made the whole problem you mentioned even more incomprehensible.
I'm just reminding people who use Battalion 101, ordinary
men. Devastating. Yes.
It seems one of the issues with this piece is he essentially is putting it into that realm of it's a test.
Life is a test.
We're given the choice of good or evil, and that this is all God's test.
Well, right, life is a test. Not that, right. Yeah, not that God brought the Holocaust as a test, but life is a test. And he also says in that same article that part of the element of tshuva, that God doesn't punish us right away, means that more people suffer. God's choice to allow wicked people time to stop being wicked means every minute of the day that they continue being wicked, somebody else is suffering for that option. Right? Because God waits patiently for people to change, means that there's a price paid for that. And typically, we love that option when it applies to us. Right? We all like the fact that God will wait for us to change, but we hate it when somebody else is hurting us, and God, then we want justice right away, if you've noticed. That's called being very human. But it is part of the problem that Berkowitz is mentioning. We're going to close now so no one's late for class. I think there's a big question floating above all of these things, and I think if you'll notice, there's not a lot of Holocaust theology written. My sense, we could have thrown Yitz Greenberg into the mix and some others, but post-Holocaust theology did not become a massive field with bookcase after bookcase of books written on this topic. And I think that there's a really challenging dilemma to think about in terms of how much of a role should the Holocaust play in our theology and our relationship to Judaism today. I don't know if there's an answer to that question, but I think it's something that, Jessica, just give me one more second, please. Guys, just give me one more second to finish. I think that that is itself a really interesting question to think about. Now that you've had this experience, what are the ways in which you see this experience affecting your beliefs about God, Judaism, and the world? And not all of you will react the same. I'm just saying it's something really interesting to think about. How will the fact that you walked through Auschwitz affect your notion of Jewish belief and Jewish identity and your own personal theology? And I think I have a sense that the Jewish people have not done enough work yet in this regard. And maybe because it's too soon, as somebody implied, or maybe we don't have the tools, but I have a sense that there's more to come in this story. But I really do hope that you'll think about the question, because I think it's a really important question that because you walked where you walked, you can ask in a way that other people cannot. So to be continued in, I think, hopefully a profound way. Okay.